Sir Charles Wetherell never expected a warm welcome in Bristol. The year was 1831, and Britons were butting heads over the hot-button issue of parliamentary reform. By the beginning of the 19th century, the delegation of seats in Parliament no longer reflected the geographical distribution of the British population. So-called rotten boroughs enjoyed inflated representation. For example, if you lived in Boroughbridge, a constituency with a mere 48 electors, your tiny hamlet got 2 seats in Parliament. Imagine the anger of those who came from cities like Bristol. In 1831, roughly 100,000 people called Bristol home. And how many MPs could they send to Westminster? 2, the exact same number as the rotten borough of Boroughbridge. Sir Charles Wetherell was no friend of the reform movement. As it happens, he represented Boroughbridge, and he understood that reformers meant to eliminate his seat, among others. Wetherell was particularly unpopular in Bristol because in 1830, he had the temerity to stand before Parliament and falsely assert that Bristol broadly opposed electoral reform. In fact, some 17,000 of the city's residents had signed a petition demanding an overhaul of the electoral system. Tempers were already running high in 1831 when the second reform bill came up for a vote in Parliament. It passed the House of Commons only to die in the House of Lords, arousing indignation across the United Kingdom. On October 29th, Wetherell, an opponent of the reform bill, traveled to Bristol to meet with its mayor, Charles Penny. Expecting trouble, local authorities took measures to keep his arrival secret. Despite these precautions, protesters learned of Wetherell's itinerary and pelted his and Penny's carriage with stones, forcing them to seek shelter at the mayor's residence, Mansion House. Rioters stormed the property and ran amok inside, emptying the wine cellar of its finest vintages and finally setting the building alight. In a last-ditch effort to escape the blaze, Wetherell clambered onto the rooftop and fled to a neighboring edifice. Destruction spread outward from Mansion House. Armed with sticks, railings, pokers, and other improvised weapons, rioters burned down houses, warehouses, and assembly rooms along the heavily trafficked thoroughfares of King Street and Prince's Street. The sky crimsoned with the conflagration, which grew to such proportions that you could see it miles away in Newport, Wales. As the mob wreaked havoc in Bristol, they gave voice to revolutionary sentiments. One man scaled a statue of King William III riding a horse and shouted for liberty, a tricolor cockade on his head and a torch in one hand. Others roared, "Down with churches and mend the roads with them!" Shocked by the violence, an estimated 3,000 middle-class residents volunteered to aid military forces on the morning of October 31st, more than 24 hours after the chaos had broken out. Later that day, they finally succeeded in quelling the riot. As many as 250 people lost their lives in the uprising, with up to £300,000 worth of property damage. Newspapers ran apocalyptic reports about the casualties. Severed heads charred black by flames and torsos stripped of limbs figured in the coverage. In the words of diarist Charles Grenville, quote, "The business at Bristol, for brutal ferocity and wanton, unprovoked violence, may vie with some of the worst scenes from the French Revolution," unquote. Madame Tussaud and Sons almost fell victim to the carnage. At the time of the revolt, they were exhibiting in assembly rooms on Prince's Street. Arsonists threatened to raise the premises to the ground, and the Tussauds went into high gear, hoping to salvage whatever they could of the collection before the venue went up in flames. An article in the Bristol Gazette notes, quote, "During this awful state of suspense, Madame Tussaud and her family experienced the most painful anxiety. It was stated that the assembly rooms marked out for destruction contained, at that time, their invaluable collection of wax figures. These, at an imminent risk of injury, were partly removed as hastily as circumstances would permit," unquote. The article went on, quote, "The house in which Madame Tussaud lodged on the opposite side of the street was among the number which became ignited from the firing of the west side of the square, and we regret to hear that the lady's constitution has received a very severe shock," unquote. Tussaud had seen more than her fair share of anarchic violence, and there's little doubt her thoughts shot back to the blood-stained avenues of revolutionary Paris as she hurried her handiwork out of harm's way on the burning streets of Bristol. The period of time from the late 1700s to the mid-19th century is sometimes referred to as the Age of Revolution because so many revolutionary movements cropped up. Revolution never came to Great Britain, and yet disturbances like the Bristol riots revealed a hunger for radical change among certain segments of the population. In 1838, Tussaud capitalized on another deadly uprising, this one led by a failed politician and murderous cult leader. Today, we'll hear how Tussaud made London her permanent home, how she became one of the capital's most successful showwomen in a matter of years, and how the aspiring member of parliament, Sir William Courtney, carried out a murder that led to the government massacre of agricultural workers outside Canterbury. This is The Art of Crime, and I'm your host, Gavin Whitehead. Welcome to Episode 7 of Queen of Crime, The Baker Street Bazaar and the Cult Leader of Kent. After surviving the Bristol riots of 1831, Tussaud and her family allowed themselves little time to rest and recuperate. They resumed touring and remained on the road for the next 4 years. In spring 1835, they made a return trip to London, having stopped there 2 years prior. By this time, Tussaud had been on the road with her exhibition since 1802, when she first left Paris for the British capital. From that point forward, her boundless stamina and will to prosper had propelled her through 33 years of arduous travel. She may have turned 73 in 1835, but this grandmother juggernaut showed no signs of slowing down. Rule number one for itinerant entertainers was simple. Staying put meant going broke. After finding a suitable spot for her waxworks in London, Tussaud signed a short-term lease, fully prepared to pack up and move on in the near future. The latest home of Madame Tussaud's was the Baker Street Bazaar, a handsome three-story building in between Dorset and King Street. Offering a blend of retail and entertainment, bazaars attracted an urbane, middle-class clientele, much like the assembly rooms that Tussaud had favored in the provinces. Bazaars multiplied in London after the conclusion of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815. Before it was converted into the Baker Street Bazaar, the structure housed the King Street Barracks. In 1815, the British Army's most senior regiment, known as the Life Guards, saddled up and set out from this very barracks to face off against Napoleon at Waterloo. Never missing a chance to impress patrons with the history of her new headquarters, Tussaud often related that her main showroom had previously served as the Life Guards' mess hall. Joseph and Francis Tussaud spared no expense in tricking out the bazaar for the exhibition's opening. At their behest, a team of specialists designed what was billed as the Golden Corinthian Saloon to the tune of £1,100. The showroom was decorated with rich crimson drapery, papier-mâché ornaments, and pilasters with gilded Corinthian capitals. One journalist raved, quote, "The whole appearance on entering, more especially in the evening, when the whole is beautifully illuminated, is peculiarly imposing and splendid," unquote. Extravaganzas like this one reveal the circular movement of money at Tussaud's. First, they raked it in at the cash box. Then, they invested it right back into the exhibition. This, in turn, allowed for novel, more spectacular attractions and thus greater profit. In late 1836, the Tussaud celebrated the biggest boom in business since they had set up in the Baker Street Bazaar. That September, superlative opera singer Maria Malibran passed away. Born to a Spanish family of musical prodigies, Malibran stunned audiences from New York City to Milan with her miles-wide vocal range and powerhouse delivery. Rossini gushed of her, quote, "She surpassed all who sought to emulate her, and with her superior mind, her breadth of knowledge, and unimaginable fieriness of temperament, she outshone all other women I have known," unquote. In July 1836, she fell from her horse, sustaining permanent injuries. Then, in September, she collapsed on stage while performing an encore in Manchester, England. 1 week later, the diva was dead. Waves of mourning spread across England, and as per usual, public sentiment guided programming at the Wax Museum. Many years after Madame Tussaud's passing, her grandson, Victor, wrote in a letter to her great-grandson, John Theodore, Quote, "The sensation caused by Malibran's death was immense, and the newspapers in England and on the continent were full of various accounts, and for a time, little else was talked about. It was then that your grandfather modeled a most excellent likeness of the cantatrice, by which he means Malibran. The attraction was so great that the rooms were thronged for many months," unquote. Indeed, ledgers show that earnings doubled during this period. Recent improvements in mass transportation accounted for the windfall. Starting in the 1830s, steam-powered trains enabled more people to travel faster than ever before. Many who came to pay their respects to the wax in Malibran on Baker Street would have journeyed to London by rail. As out-of-towners streamed into the bazaar, a realization dawned on Tussaud. In the age of the stagecoach, she had gone to her customers. In the age of the railway, they would come to her. This consideration, more than any other, motivated Tussaud to enter more than three decades of touring and establish a permanent location in London. With her mind made up, she moved into a house that adjoined the Wax Museum and overlooked Baker Street. Over the course of the next decade, Tussaud updated her trove of waxworks with characteristic frequency and landed on a layout for the museum. The bazaar's ground floor did not belong to the Tussauds. The occupants of that story sold horses and carriages. They also hosted the annual Royal Smithfield Cattle Club show, along with the occasional poultry show. To reach Tussauds, you bypassed the horses, chickens, and cattle, headed down a hallway lined with modern and classical statuary, and finally took a magnificent staircase up one level. You never would have guessed it based on the odor of horse manure downstairs, but a sumptuous salon waited above the stables. Playing the part of hostess, Madame Tussaud greeted you at the cash table and sold you a ticket, along with a catalog if you cared to purchase one. Matronly in both appearance and bearing, Tussaud dressed in what one museum goer called, quote, her veritable black silk cloak and bonnet, unquote. Once you paid, you were at liberty to wander the main showroom of the exhibition. Initially referred to as the Great Room, it measured 100 feet by 50, and it was nothing if not opulent. Plate glass mirrors covered the walls, as well as scarlet drapery and gilded ornamentation, in homage to the court of Louis XIV. Individual effigies, as well as small groups, were arranged around a central tableau. Much as you might find in a modern art gallery, ottomans and sofas were scattered throughout, allowing patrons to sit and relax or study the displays. The orchestra supplied music from a balcony situated above the main entrance. Responding to the atmosphere of refinement at the Wax Museum, one that Tussaud had always cultivated, a visitor enthused, quote, "This is one of the most delightful salons in London. The first people of the day, past and present, appear as if attracted by the hospitality of Madame. It is true that they remain silent, but an acquaintanceship with phrenology compensates for that defect to logicians," unquote. Something tells me that last sentence was funnier in the 1840s. On the far side of the main showroom, a doorway led to the Golden Room, later rechristened the Hall of Kings. As the name implies, this exhibit celebrated the monarchy with sculptures of Henry VIII, Elizabeth, Charles I, Mary Queen of Scots, along with the Hanoverians. A tableau of King George IV's coronation, which we talked about last time, remained a popular attraction for many years, not least because the sovereign's likeness was dressed in robes that George had worn for the occasion, rumored to have cost an astronomical £18,000. Tussaud bought them for the remarkably marked down price of £300. In 1837, the youthful Victoria ascended the throne, and in 1840, she married the love of her life, Prince Albert. In 1846, Tussauds unveiled a tableau of the royal family entitled Sweet Home, the name inspired by the wildly popular song Home Sweet Home. It portrayed Victoria and Albert at home, quote, sitting on a magnificent sofa and caressing their lovely children, unquote. In the words of an eyewitness, quote, the whole was intended to convey an idea of that sweet home for which every Englishman feels that love and respect which can but end with their lives, unquote. Since arriving in England in 1802, Tussaud had tapped into the British fascination with their great nemesis, France. In 1843, she took things to a whole new level when she opened two rooms dedicated to Napoleon Bonaparte. In fact, Tussauds amassed the world's premier collection of Napoleonic relics. It may seem strange that Britons still cared about Napoleon, let alone felt a certain awe of him. His fall had been devastating, spectacular, and almost absurd, like a rhinestoned piano dropping out of the sky. In 1815, while Madame Tussaud was still touring with Joseph, the emperor suffered a decisive defeat at Waterloo. On June 22nd of that year, lacking support in France, Napoleon abdicated. "I offer myself in sacrifice," he declared. "My political life is over." Advisors counseled him to seek asylum in the United States, where he proposed to live out the rest of his days as a humble farmer. "They will give me some land, or I shall buy some, and I shall live on the products of my fields and flocks," he mused to an aide. Instead, the British exiled him, the man who had dreamed of dominating Europe, to a dust pile of an island in the middle of the Atlantic, St. Helena, 10.5 miles long by 6.5 miles wide. Craggy, windy, and perennially rain-soaked, parts of this volcanic outcropping were uninhabitable, and to call it isolated would have been an understatement. St. Helena was located 1,200 miles from the west coast of Africa and nearly 2,000 from the shores of Brazil. Upon his arrival in mid-October of 1815, Napoleon rued the life choices that had brought him here. Quote, "This is not a happy place to live. I should have stayed in Egypt. I would now be emperor of the entire Orient," unquote. After 6 years of unhappy exile, Napoleon died on May 29th, 1821, aged 51, probably of hepatitis followed by stomach cancer. Despite this ignominious death, Napoleon lost none of his larger-than-life status. Indeed, now that this Corsican megalomaniac was out of the picture, it may have felt safer for the British to indulge their abiding curiosity about him. Tussaud had them covered. In the so-called Shrine of Napoleon, the first of two chambers given over to him, patrons could eyeball his waxen likeness, based on a painting by Jacques-Louis David. The figure wore clothes that Napoleon himself had worn on St. Helena. You could see several objects related to his death, the blood-stained bed in which the exile had breathed his last breath, for example. Also on view was a deep blue cloak that had served as his funeral shroud. Yet other objects reminded museum goers that part of Napoleon still lived on. A cradle that had belonged to the emperor's infant son. A wax model of the baby lay swaddled inside. These objets paled in comparison to the pièce de résistance, the carriage in which Napoleon escaped from Waterloo. Another London-based showman named William Bullock, proprietor of the famous Egyptian Hall, purchased this vehicle and put it on display shortly after Napoleon's downfall. Bullock eventually sold it off, and sometime in the early to mid-1830s, an unnamed member of the Tussaud clan spotted it motoring in the Gray Inns Road Bazaar in London. Whoever this was liked the idea of adding the conveyance to the wax museum. 52 pounds and the carriage was theirs. This bad boy was equal parts armored tank, first-class train coach, and Lamborghini. Equipped with navy blue, bulletproof paneling emblazoned with the imperial coat of arms, the carriage was designed for maximum speed on the battlefield. The interior contained multiple compartments in which Napoleon had stored pistols and other weapons. A movable desk could be drawn out in which the emperor might have stored jewelry, money, maps, or other items. He could also put the top down if he so chose. Divided into two parts, the roof of this pre-modern convertible could fold both backward and forward, while the window supports were collapsible. Napoleon dined inside with gold and silver eating utensils embossed with the letter N and the imperial coat of arms in case anyone should forget to whom the carriage belonged. After dinner, you could lift up the seats and unfold a bed that was mounted on casters. When the vehicle first went on display at Tussauds, visitors were allowed to climb on board and sit inside, some even munching on sandwiches as they did so. Refreshments were available for purchase at the museum. Management revoked this privilege, however, after vandals peeled strips of the carriage's wooden interior to take home as souvenirs. Even so, the Waterloo carriage proved so magnetic that Tussauds exhibited a fleet of other vehicles associated with Napoleon. Today, the London location of Madame Tussauds ranks among the British capital's foremost tourist destinations. Believe it or not, it had already achieved this status in Tussauds' lifetime. Just a few years after her passing, Charles Dickens reflected on the lasting popularity of the establishment. Quote, "Visitors from the country go to see those waxworks if they go nowhere else. Tradesmen living in the neighborhood put 'Near Madame Tussauds' on their cards. The omnibuses which run down Baker Street announce that they pass that deceased lady's as a means of getting customers. And there's scarcely a cab horse in London but would make an instinctive offer to stop at the well-known entrance to Tussauds," unquote. Despite her international acclaim, Tussauds had plenty of haters too. In 1854, a troll who wrote for the Illustrated Family Standard depicted her wax museum as a tawdry tourist trap. Quote, "During a late sojourn in London, one of my first expeditions was to Madame Tussauds, a place that everybody sees or has seen, but which it is nevertheless the fashion in London to laugh at as being the delight and resort of the wonder-seeking, horror-loving country bumpkins who visit town," unquote. There's little doubt some Londoners rolled their eyes at Tussauds, but this appraisal by no means negates the countless, genuinely glowing reviews that newspapers published about the establishment. Circa 1844, a blast from the past threatened to destroy everything that Tussauds had built in London. One day, she received a letter from one of her least favorite people, her husband, Francois, now 72. There's no indication that Monsieur and Madame Tussauds had ever corresponded since 1808. Francois' out-of-the-blue communication reached Tussauds by way of a French acquaintance of his who lived in London, a widow by the name of Madame Castile. Francois' motive for writing was outright outrageous. As Marie's husband, Francois asserted his legal right to take possession of her inheritance from Philippe Curtiou. This went against their prenuptial agreement, which allowed Marie to retain control of her assets contrary to custom. Madame Castile characterized Marie's reaction to his letter as follows, quote, "She appears to hold against you certain very grave reasons for dissatisfaction, since in the first place, she seemed not at all pleased to hear from you and told me that she had transferred all her possessions to her sons," unquote. That must have stung, and Madame Castile would have only made it worse when she unintentionally rubbed his wife's success in his face. She advised him, quote, "You can write to her at this very short address, Madame Tussauds, as your wife is very well known in London. It is impossible to describe the beauty and richness of this exhibition. In all my life, I have never seen anything more magnificent," unquote. Marie never acknowledged Francois' claim in writing, but it clearly had her worried. If he was serious about seizing her assets, he could assert ownership of the Baker Street exhibition. And if she died before him, he might just succeed. He was her husband. Horrified by the thought of it, Marie consulted a lawyer and signed articles of partnership with her sons. These documents ensured that her business would transfer to Joseph and Francis upon her passing. Nothing daunted, Francois kept writing to the famous Madame Tussauds. She never once responded. Instead, Joseph and Francis wrote back to him jointly, declaring their official partnership with her. In December 1844, they co-authored a letter that is hard to read for its brutal candor. Quote, "You left mother in debt and difficulty in London, all of which she overcame by hard work and perseverance, without asking from you one sou from your own pocket. Up to the present time, you have not sent any money to help her. On the contrary, you have sent no details of her business in Paris and the profits from that business, of which you alone have had the benefits for many years. We believe, with mother, that she has no reason to have any regard for you, who have treated her in such a way. I can assure that every time you write, mother becomes ill, and above all, when you write that you will come and see her. It is too ridiculous for words," unquote. As much as their father sickened their mother, Joseph and Francis would not forsake him. They sent money every now and again and reportedly went for a visit in Paris, the first time that Francis had set foot in his birthplace for more than 20 years and Joseph for more than 40. According to family lore, Marie went berserk over this perceived betrayal, and Joseph could not bring himself to occupy the same room as Francois. The neglectful gold digger kept needling his family until he finally died in 1848. A at the Baker Street Bazaar, Tussaud exploited the craze for true crime as she never had before. After molding a sculpture of Edward Marcus Despard in 1803, Tussaud went exactly 25 years before immortalizing another criminal in wax. First came William Quarter in 1828, then Burke and Hare in 1829. Encouraged by the immense popularity of these figures, Tussaud began expanding her Hall of Infamy whenever a horrible murder made national headlines. In the early 1840s, she named her rogues gallery the Chamber of Horrors, a moniker often attributed to Punch, a satirical magazine, though probably minted by one of the Tussauds. After exploring the rest of the waxworks, you forked over an additional sixpence to enter the Chamber of Horrors. The chamber was gloomy, and according to Charles Dickens, quote, the stormier and more untidy passages, unquote, of the orchestra's music penetrated the exhibit, imbuing it with, quote, an inexpressible dreariness, unquote. In the middle of the room stood the Marat tableau, along with special exhibits, while death heads of French revolutionaries adorned the walls. Most of the models stood to one side in a large wooden structure called the Dock, based on its counterpart at the Old Bailey, London's criminal court. The pantheon of murderers featured the likes of Giuseppe Fieschi, the chief conspirator in a bid to assassinate King Louis-Philippe of France in 1835, James Greenacre, the London grocer, who dismembered his fiancée after she misled him about her finances in 1837, and François Courvoisier, the Swiss-born valet who slashed his master's throat before robbing him in 1840. Yet there was a moralizing dimension to the chamber as well. In this cross between a showroom and a courtroom, the oversized dock reminded patrons that the criminals inside it had gone to trial for their crimes and paid with their lives. The moral was straightforward. Remember, kids, killing people is bad. As the Chamber of Horrors grew in popularity, Madame Tussauds displayed fewer and fewer likenesses of criminals who had committed political crimes. Many, maybe most, of the men and women who wound up depicted in Tussauds' dock were guilty of domestic murder. However, in 1838, the Chamber of Horrors introduced an effigy of a murderer who spearheaded a rebellion of agricultural laborers that ended in tragedy. We'll hear the whole story after a quick break.
Hey everyone, it's Gavin. If you're liking this episode of The Art of Crime, please do me a favor and tell someone about it on social media. If you're active on Reddit, Instagram, or Facebook, I would love it if you posted about The Art of Crime today whenever you have a few minutes. Or if you follow relevant message boards or blogs, it'd be awesome if you posted there too. I'm telling every stranger I meet about this podcast, but there are only so many strangers where I live. So I would be eternally grateful if you helped me out however you can. Thanks so much, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode.
In September 1832, a newcomer to Canterbury in southeastern England had the whole town talking. Aged 33, he went by the name of Count Moses Rothschild and claimed to descend from distinguished Jewish ancestors. Count Rothschild stood an imposing 6 feet tall, spoke with a booming baritone voice, and wore his black hair long with a bushy beard. Exceedingly handsome, the nobleman also had a passion for fashion, albeit fashion from a bygone era. On any given day, he might have sported a gold-trimmed crimson velvet vest along with a mantle of the same material, making it seem as if he had fallen out of the Tudor age and tumbled into Victorian England. Shortly after arriving in Canterbury, Count Rothschild took a room at the Rose Inn, situated on the corner of Rose Lane and the main drag, quickly ingratiating himself among the locals. Like plenty of aristocrats, the Count had no need to work for a living, and spent most of his days sauntering from one pub to the next and shooting the breeze with anyone who cared to. He styled himself as a friend of the people, and made charitable donations to the poor and needy of Canterbury. Apart from this munificence, his love of lampooning high-ranking officials like the local mayor and the Archbishop of Canterbury greatly endeared him to the average Joes around town. Count Rothschild surprised those who knew him a week or two after his arrival in Canterbury, when all of a sudden he reinvented himself. He now called himself Sir William Percy Honeywood Courtney, Knight of Malta, the rightful heir to the Earldom of Devon. Sir William Courtney is how most of his contemporaries came to know him, so I'm using that name for the rest of this episode. Among his many grand pronouncements, Courtney maintained that he had inherited Hale Place, a mansion located outside the city in the middle of a scenic park. One day, he went to the property and announced himself as the rightful owner. When he did so, however, a member of the household balked at the claim and shooed him from the grounds. In view of this and other embarrassments, many residents of Canterbury regarded Sir William as an imposter, but that didn't mean they liked him any less. Quite the contrary, Courtney's apparent, who needs it, outlook on truth only increased his popularity. After a few short months, Sir William made an unexpected bid for Parliament. In early 1832, after failing the previous year, the Reform Bill made it through both the House of Commons and the House of Lords. Enthusiasm for reform ran high in Canterbury, and it was expected that the Liberal Whigs would clean up at the polls. As a result, it was assumed that the Conservative Tories would not stand a chance and would waste their time in even nominating a candidate. When a leading Whig politician, the Honorable Richard Watson, made a snide remark to that effect in public, however, the Tories hatched a plan that was not meant to win them any seats at Westminster, but rather to irritate the hell out of the Whigs. To that end, the Conservatives sat down with the intoxicating Sir William Courtney and proposed that he run for Parliament. Courtney was no Tory, but the meeting gave him an idea. The Knight of Malta registered as an independent, entering the race as the sole challenger to two Whigs. Sir William ran on a populist platform and called on voters to shun political parties. Quote, "Any man who belongs to a party, whether Tory or Whig, cannot serve the public," unquote. If elected, he would eradicate all forms of injustice and even just inconvenience from the face of the planet. Slavery, taxes, the laws of primogeniture, all would be dismantled under his leadership. At one event, he vowed to restore, quote, "the good old days of roast beef and mutton and plenty of prime nut brown ale," unquote. A winning platform if ever I've heard one. Sir William's promise of radical reform and revitalization energized a substantial percentage of the public, making him a hero in the eyes of his supporters. While campaigning, he rode around town in a horse-drawn carriage, stopping to hold forth in front of a crowd whenever he could. On one occasion, a speech of Sir William's so riled up his listeners that a group of them released the horses from their reins and took their places at the front of the carriage. They insisted on pulling the conveyance, their champion still aboard, back to his headquarters at the Rose Inn. There, Courtney delivered a spirited address from the balcony, scattering coins like so much confetti among the crowd before disappearing into his rooms. A reporter for the Times described the joyful rally as, quote, "a scene bordering much on the ludicrous," unquote. Regardless of such snipes, Election Day proved that many in Canterbury took Sir William and his populism seriously. Voters went to the polls on Wednesday, December 12th, with the results tallied by the late afternoon. The Honorable Richard Watson received 834 votes, while his fellow Whig, Lord Fordwich, garnered 802. Sir William Courtney earned 375. The Knight of Malta had lost. After the results came in, the Honorable Richard Watson snarked at Sir William's expense in the packed Guild Hall, thanking the electorate for choosing him, that is, Watson, who dressed in unremarkable attire over the, quote, "Knight of Malta in his gorgeous apparel," unquote. What a shame Sir William missed out on a seat at Westminster, Watson vamped. But hey, maybe he could rename himself Lord Viscount Courtney and wriggle his way into the House of Lords. This was a sick burn by 19th century standards, but Watson failed to realize that Courtney and his followers were there in full force. They booed with such anger that the MP was forced to pipe down. Then, jeers turned to cheers as Courtney leapt onto a table and gave an impromptu oration. He called out the Tories for exploiting the working classes and went after the Whigs for watering down the reform movement. Then, spurred on by his own righteous fury, he spun to face Watson and declared that he, a man of high birth, could wear whatever he damn well pleased without the permission of elected officials. Courtney might have lost the election, but as the roars of applause made plain, he had trounced Watson in this war of words. Though disappointing, Sir William's defeat struck many as a victory. True, he had finished dead last, but let's not forget that he had first shown his face in Canterbury just 3 months before running for Parliament and without any prior political experience. Despite all this, well over a sixth of the voting population cast a ballot for him. This strong showing inspired Courtney to run for Parliament in East Kent as well. Unfortunately, that campaign ended in unmitigated disaster, with Sir William earning a dispiriting 3 votes. Courtney's no-two-ways-about-it rout in East Kent led to further disgrace in 1833. On February 17th of that year, the Lively, a ship under the command of one Lieutenant Shambler, caught sight of the Admiral Hood, a fishing vessel suspected of smuggling. Keeping a watchful eye on the Admiral Hood, the crew of the Lively observed them throwing tubs overboard near the shores of the Goodwin Sands, off the eastern coast of England. Given this suspicious activity, the Lively closed in on the Admiral Hood, ordering the latter to heave to. The situation escalated, with the Lively firing warning shots and then giving chase as the Admiral Hood tried to escape. In the end, the fugitives were forced to drop anchor. Members of the Lively team recovered the tubs and opened them to discover contraband liquor inside. The 7 men aboard the Admiral Hood were charged with smuggling. Sir William took more than a casual interest in the case. He wanted to do whatever he could to exonerate the crew of the Admiral Hood. It's unclear whether he fully believed in their innocence, but he certainly aimed to score political points by making a spectacle of siding with the little guy, in this case, a group of humble fishermen. The trial took place on March 1st in Rochester, and Courtney saw to it that he could attend. Before the proceedings could begin in earnest, Sir William shot to his feet and asked Thomas Colrope, the first defendant and the Admiral Hood skipper, whether he wished to stick with his trained attorney, Mr. Langham, or whether he wished to have him, that is, Courtney, act as his lawyer instead. With his 6-foot figure and stentorian voice, the would-be advocate made such an impression that Colrope took him up on his offer. He soon came to regret this decision. In the absence of evidence to vindicate the skipper, Courtney quoted scripture and heavily implied that Lieutenant Shambler, commander of the Lively, had lied in his testimony. Sir William's remarks reached a spectacular climax when he unsheathed the scimitar he wore at his side and laid it on a table, swearing that he would defend truth and justice with his sword if need be. Courtney's one-man show left the jury unconvinced. They fined the skipper £100, recommending imprisonment if he could not afford to pay. Alarmed by the verdict, the 6 remaining crew members of the Admiral Hood were none too keen to repeat the skipper's mistake. They forcefully rejected Sir William's offer to argue their case. Instead, they entrusted their defense to Mr. Langham, the credentialed attorney. Though shut out of lawyering, Courtney assured the court that he would provide evidence to establish the fisherman's innocence. Taking a seat in the witness box at the appropriate moment, Sir William testified that, quote, on the day in question, unquote, he was returning to England from France aboard a vessel called the Action. In his biography of Courtney, P.G. Rogers points out that the name of this ship curiously recalled that of the Lively. As he crossed the channel, Sir William stated, he happened to spot tubs adrift in the sea, floating toward the Action in a westerly direction. He was certain these tubs were the same ones the Lively retrieved from the depths, and equally certain that they had not come from the Admiral Hood. Why this was certain was a mystery to everyone else in the courtroom. After a perfunctory cross-examination, Courtney left the stand, confident that he had secured an acquittal. There, he was mistaken. The jury found all 6 crew members guilty. Outraged, Courtney glared at Lieutenant Shambler and declared that he was prepared to test the entire crew of the Lively in mortal combat the very next morning. Hardly anybody paid attention to this challenge. Court was adjourned and spectators were already filing out of the building. On March 18th, the thwarted advocate, witness, and duelist received grim tidings. In the wake of the Admiral Hood affair, the prosecution determined that Sir William had lied under oath, and now they were indicting him on charges of perjury. The trial commenced on July 25th at the Kent Summer Assizes and drew spectators from near and far, since it revolved around Courtney, something of a local celebrity. After a monotonous start to the proceedings, a tremor of excitement rippled through the court as the key witness for the prosecution came forward. This was Mr. T.W. Wright, vicar of Boughton-under-Bleane, a village about 6 miles outside Canterbury. Mr. Wright testified that he had performed his duties at church on Sunday, February 17th, the day Lieutenant Shambler placed the crew of the Admiral Hood under arrest. That morning and afternoon, Mr. Wright observed the defendant, a man of extreme piety, sitting in a pew. Another witness corroborated the vicar's testimony, causing Courtney to roll his eyes and scowl. Clearly, he had not been aboard the action crossing the English Channel. The case for the Crown was unassailable, and nobody was surprised when the jury handed down a guilty verdict. Nobody, that is, except Sir William. Utterly thunderstruck, he staggered to the dock and professed his innocence. In a series of statements that many viewed as poignant, Courtney implored the judge to show mercy and declared his great affection for those present. Quote, "If you knew the love I have for you all, that I would take every one of you to my bosom, and that I would lay down my life for every one of you, you would not think me capable of this crime. I ought to have the justice of an Englishman. I am descended of the best blood of my country," unquote. Courtney's pleadings and protestations would not suffice to soften the judge's heart. He sentenced the perjurer to 3 months' confinement in an English prison, after which Sir William would be transported to Australia for 10 years. Courtney would never set foot in Australia. In August, a month or so after the trial's conclusion, a woman from Cornwall on the other side of England traveled to Maidstone with a shocking revelation. She introduced herself as Catherine Tom and suspected that Courtney was her husband, John Nichols, a suspicion she formed after hearing about Courtney's trial. The governor of Maidstone Jail brought her to see Sir William, at which point she provided a positive identification. Catherine confirmed the many doubts about Sir William's supposedly blue-blooded parentage. The son of two innkeepers, he grew up in Cornwall. After studying law for a spell, he took a job as a clerk, or as the British would say, a clerk, at Lubbock & Co., wine merchants based in the Cornish town of Truro. When the owners retired, Courtney took over, marrying Catherine in 1821. 10 years later, the wine merchant received treatment for, quote, "an attack of insanity," unquote, after which he made a speedy recovery. In spring 1832, he sailed to Liverpool with the aim of selling malt. His family never saw him again until they caught wind of a guy in Canterbury going by the name of Sir William Courtney. According to rumor, he fit the description of Catherine's absentee spouse. Courtney denied any relationship with Catherine, but the medical community believed her account. Concerned about Courtney's history of mental illness, two surgeons examined him and declared him to be of unsound mind. Sir William served his 3-month sentence in prison, and then, on October 28, 1833, the authorities transferred him to Barming Health Asylum. Several observers have questioned whether Courtney actually suffered from mental illness. Those who examined him at the psychiatric hospital diagnosed him with religious monomania, based on his obsessive stream-of-consciousness diatribes related to Christianity. However, another contemporary who knew Sir William insisted that he was feigning both his religious fervor and his mental instability, describing them as, quote, "an artful contrivance," unquote. In his book about Courtney, historian Barry Ray notes that Sir William did suffer bouts of insanity at times when they seemingly worked to his advantage, perhaps suggesting that he was putting on an act. For instance, Sir William was able to evade transportation precisely because the doctors deemed him unstable. In the end, however, Ray dismisses the idea that Courtney was faking it. His behavior in the last year of his life certainly pointed toward mental disturbance. We'll hear how it ended after a quick break.
Hello! If you listened to the previous season of The Art of Crime, then you know it's about assassination. I want to let you know about 2 patrons-only bonus episodes related to that topic that you can access now if you sign up as a patron of The Art of Crime. The first is about Roderick MacLean, the aspiring poet who attempted to assassinate Queen Victoria and almost succeeded in 1882. The second is one of my favorite Art of Crime episodes to date. It's about contemporary Iranian photographer Azadeh Akhlaqi. Akhlaqi reconstructed the 1924 assassination of playwright, poet, and firebrand journalist Mirzadeh Eshki as part of her incredible photo series, By an Eyewitness. More bonus episodes about this season's topic will be available soon. So, if you want more Art of Crime in your life, please consider becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/artofcrimepodcast. Again, that's www.patreon.com/artofcrimepodcast.
Courtney spent 4 years at Barming Health. In 1837, considering the patient's exemplary behavior, the superintendent recommended that Catherine petition the Home Secretary for her husband's release. In one of her earliest acts as monarch, Queen Victoria pardoned Sir William. It was at first stipulated that Courtney live with his father in Cornwall, but Courtney refused. Instead, he was allowed to move in with a Mr. Francis of Fairbrook, a wealthy farmer who resided in Boughton under Blean. By January 1838, Sir William had made an enemy of Mr. Francis, so he moved into the home of the Culver family at Bosenden Farm, a property that abutted Bosenden Wood. The farmhouse stood at the end of a narrow lane surrounded by meadows. Over the next few months, the Knight of Malta became acquainted with the neighborhood's impoverished smallholders, tradesmen, and agricultural laborers. More like a cult leader than a political organizer, Courtney cast himself as their savior, vowing to rid their lives of chronic unemployment and poverty. He even called himself Christ reincarnated. Stirred by Courtney's way with words and his utopian vision of economic equality, somewhere between 2 and 3 dozen men pledged their allegiance to him. Like so many disciples, they accompanied him on his daily wanderings and listened to his teachings. Their activities remained peaceful, but Courtney's rhetoric at times turned violent. Several townsfolk watched these gatherings of aggrieved agricultural laborers with increasing alarm, worried that they could give rise to violence. Still fresh memories of the Bristol riots, not to mention other recent disturbances, fed these fears. Finally, on May 30th, one Dr. Poor issued a warrant for Courtney's arrest. The task of executing said warrant fell to John Mears, a plumber by profession who also acted as High Constable of Boughton under Blean. Sir William had a habit of rising early, John knew, so he planned to set out at 4:30 the next morning and confront the wanted man at Bosenden Farm. Not wishing to make the pre-dawn journey all alone, especially since Courtney and his followers might put up a fight, John enlisted the aid of his assistant, Daniel Edwards, as well as John's brother, Nicholas. A sense of foreboding fell like a pall over Nicholas Mears. He confided in his wife on the morning of the mission that his gut was telling him to stay away. It was only his fraternal loyalty to John and his desire to protect him from harm that motivated him to go. Mrs. Mears had her own misgivings, but she kept them to herself, reminding her husband that by reputation, Courtney insisted on law and order. She saw Nicholas out the door and waved goodbye as he walked down the road to the rendezvous point. Before long, the Mears brothers and Edwards were plodding down the lane to Bosenden Farm, an uneasy silence hanging in the air. Nicholas's feelings of trepidation grew heavier with each step as the farm came into view. Breaking the silence with a hushed voice, he expressed anxiety about the coming encounter. Sir William was well-built and ill-tempered. Backed into a corner, he might resort to force. Both John and Edwards tried to reassure him to no avail. Nicholas sighed that if any of them had to die that day, he hoped it would be him instead of John, for unlike his brother, Nicholas would not leave any children behind. John had little opportunity to dispel his brother's dread. They were now close enough to Bosenden Farm to make out 3 or 4 laborers milling about. Recognizing John as a member of the police force, one of these fellows ran to a window and hollered inside that the constables had come. In the meantime, John and Nicholas Mears and David Edwards climbed over a wooden stile in a fence that enclosed the southern side of the property, intent on proceeding from there to the front door. Just as they were headed that direction, Sir William emerged, ready for a fight. He wore a truculent look on his face and, more alarmingly, a pair of pistols and a sword at his side. He strode over to Nicholas, John, and Edwards and demanded, "Are you the constable?" directing his question at no one in particular. As if by reflex, both John and Nicholas answered, "Yes," at the same instant.
No sooner had they spoken than Courtney pulled a pistol and fired at Nicholas, nearly point blank. Screaming in pain, Nicholas tottered and lurched toward the fence, attempting to steady himself before crumpling to the ground. By the time he went down, Sir William had returned his firearm to his belt and drawn his sword. "Yes, and you're the other," he cried, fixing his ferocious eyes on John. He lunged toward the constable, waving his blade, but John and Edwards were too quick for him. They dodged his blow and off they dashed into the meadow, quickened by the adrenaline of mortal terror and running at top speed toward Bosendon Wood. Courtney chased after like a rabid hellhound and might have overtaken them had he not tripped over a tussock of grass and fallen to the ground. Stinging with pain as he regained his footing, he growled to himself as Mears and Edwards vanished beyond the tree line. There was no hope of catching them now. Furious, Sir William sped back to the fence where he found Nicholas right where he left him. The injured man moaned, "What am I to do? Am I to lie here in this way?" Standing over him, Sir William snarled, "You must do the best you can." Without another word, he unsheathed his sword, raised it overhead, and dealt a mighty blow to Nicholas. He repeated this motion once and then twice. Finally, he pulled his unfired pistol out of his belt and shot his victim for a second time. A small cluster of Sir William's acolytes witnessed the bloodshed speechless. Courtney had certainly made use of bloody rhetoric in the past, but never until now had he harmed another soul. Putting away his firearm, the Knight of Malta pivoted to his onlookers, suddenly more shepherd than slaughterman. "I am the savior of the world," he bellowed. "You are my true lambs, every one of you." As if to justify the savage murder, he pointed toward the corpse and proclaimed, "I have killed the body. I have saved the soul." He commanded four of the bystanders to pick up the cadaver and deposit it in a ditch. Too afraid to resist, they bent over their load and lifted it. As they did so, several of the assembly slunk away from the farmhouse, hoping to escape. However, Sir William would not abide defectors. "If anyone tries to run away," he barked, "he shall be a dead man." Nobody doubted the sincerity of this threat, and they stopped in their tracks. They watched as Nicholas's body was heaved into the ditch where it landed with a thud. Sir William jetted back into the farmhouse. Now was not the time to dally. He and his supporters needed to mobilize and make ready for battle. Police reinforcements could arrive any minute. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Sir William had corralled about 35 of his adherents and led them to a clearing in Bosendon Wood. Throughout the morning and early afternoon, he deployed several tactics to instill an esprit de corps in his men. He made vague promises of material gain. Together, they would somehow seize the estates of the wealthy and divide them up. Each man would receive at least 50 acres. He inspired awe with proclamations of his messianic status. He was Christ come again, having descended from the heavens in a cloud. One day, he would ascend to the firmament, never to return. When all else failed, he cowed his followers. If they abandoned him, he warned, fire would rain from the skies and consume them, after which they would suffer everlasting torment in hell. Asked whether it was true that he had killed Nicholas Mears, Courtney retorted, "Yes, I did shoot the vagabond, and I have eaten a hearty breakfast since." Meanwhile, news of the murder at Bosendon Farm had filtered to the authorities, and now a small army was advancing on Bosendon Wood to capture the perpetrator and his allies. A high-ranking officer, Major Armstrong, proposed a pincer formation. Another soldier, Lieutenant Bennett, would lead a detachment into Bosendon Wood from one direction and keep Courtney distracted, while Major Armstrong approached from the opposite direction. The two groups split up and enacted the plan. Before long, Lieutenant Bennett and his men were striding through the woodland. They caught sight of Sir William while they were passing along the northern lip of a land drain. The murderer had ditched his trademark crimson vest for a simple smock coat and wore a broad-brimmed hat on his head. His disciples stood around him in the clearing, equipped with staves and cudgels. Major Armstrong was drawing near, but he and his troops had encountered delays, forcing Lieutenant Bennett to stall longer than expected. The lieutenant called over to Sir William, hoping he could persuade the outlaw to stand down. Courtney was in no mood for palaver, and he was just as desperate now as he had been that morning. He walked over to Lieutenant Bennett and raised his pistol. A few yards away and sensing danger, Major Armstrong shouted for Lieutenant Bennett to fall back. To retreat was no longer an option, however, as Courtney had come within a few paces of Bennett. Projecting self-possession, the lieutenant unsheathed his sword and ordered Sir William to surrender at once. Courtney answered his command with a glare and then opened fire. Lieutenant Bennett gasped as the bullet struck him. He collapsed to the ground. A collective shout of outrage and sorrow erupted from his men. Courtney often quoted from the Book of Revelation, but he and his adherents would never come closer to the apocalypse than this moment. Shouting like madmen and brandishing their weapons, they charged Bennett's cavalry, which in turn raised their firearms and discharged a volley of bullets. Meanwhile, Major Armstrong's contingent closed in on the left flank of Sir William's band. Mindful of protocol, even under life-threatening circumstances, Major Armstrong called out to his commanding officer, "Dr. Poor, Dr. Poor, are we to fire?" Situated near the rear of the battalion, Dr. Poor likely never heard the soldier over the fray. Receiving no answer, Major Armstrong gave the signal to shoot. The clearing flashed with gunfire and resounded with the cries of wounded men. The odds were not in favor of Sir William's fighters. They were outmanned, and only two among them, Courtney and another, were carrying firearms. Nevertheless, they struck their opponents with their staves and cudgels. When these armaments were knocked or fell to the ground, they punched and kicked the enemy, their heavy boots dealing considerable damage. Major Armstrong later testified that never in all his years as an officer had he seen such frenzied, unrelenting courage. As the melee intensified, Major Armstrong commanded his soldiers to attack with their bayonets. This strategy succeeded in dispelling the renegades, who discarded their clubs and retreated into the wilderness. The soldiers pursued them until Major Armstrong instructed a bugler to sound the ceasefire. With a blast of the horn, the bloodletting ended. The Battle of Bosendon Wood, as it came to be known, lasted no longer than 3 or 4 minutes, with fewer than 60 shots discharged. By the time it was over, 8 of Sir William's party lay dead, himself included. Almost as soon as the shooting started, Sir William fell, struck by bullets from multiple directions. Thomas Milgate, a civilian who had joined forces with the soldiers, also landed a blow with a club. An additional 7 of Courtney's contingent were injured, one of whom later succumbed to his wounds. On the opposing side, Lieutenant Bennett and a special constable Cant had perished. More blood could have been shed, for sure, but the number of casualties sent shockwaves across Britain. Many regarded the violence as born of nothing but what they called Courtney's madness. However, others saw the skirmish as the product of a social and economic malaise that plagued agricultural workers in Boughton under Blean and elsewhere. Sir William was eccentric, perhaps mentally ill, some admitted. But with his brand of populist politics, he had tapped into a strain of resentment familiar to many rural Britons. On July 29, 1838, just under 2 months after the Battle of Bosendon Wood, Madame Tussaud and Sons announced the arrival of Courtney's effigy in a special advertisement. They clearly expected to do big business with the new attraction. The name Sir William Courtney, alias John Toms, appears in capital letters at the top of the notice, even above Madame Tussaud and Sons. Not surprisingly, given Tussaud's obsession with fashion, the advertisement stresses that Sir William's likeness appeared in, quote, the splendid crimson dress, unquote, that had made him so conspicuous. In this ad, as well as catalog entries about Courtney, Tussaud downplays his political ideology. The advertisement does mention his candidacy for Parliament, but the emphasis falls squarely on his mental illness. According to an 1851 catalog, Courtney's effigy wears the garb of, quote, the King of Jerusalem, unquote, a title that highlights his delusions of grandeur as well as his religious fanaticism. The same catalog entry makes no mention of the socioeconomic hardships that prompted Sir William's supporters to join with him, instead describing them as, quote, deluded, unquote. The sculpture of Sir William Courtney did not enjoy the same longevity of others in the Chamber of Horrors. Within a few decades, memories of him and the Battle of Bosendon Wood faded, a striking development since modern historians assign a good deal of significance to the Woodland bloodbath. Some have even called it the last battle fought on British soil. Still, the fever-brained publicity about the debut of Sir William's effigy suggests that Tussauds considered his likeness to be a highlight of their offerings in 1838. now firmly rooted in London, Tussaud had reached the height of her fame. Next episode, we'll hear about perhaps the single greatest controversy she provoked in her career. The firestorm started when she brought forth the figure of the glamorous murderer who had risen to infamy as a modern Lady Macbeth. You've been listening to The Art of Crime, created, written, and narrated by yours truly, Gavin Whitehead. Liam Bellman-Sharp edited sound and composed the score. Last but not least, a thousand thanks to research and production assistant Ken Symphonies. The Art of Crime is part of the Airwave Media Network. To find out more about their excellent programming, visit www.airwavemedia.com. If you like what you heard on The Art of Crime, please tell the world, by which I mean everyone you know, plus the occasional stranger. Also, if you can, take a moment to rate and review the podcast. It goes a long way in helping others find out about the show. Finally, all throughout history, artists have relied on the support of patrons to make their work. The same holds true for podcasters making shows about historical artists, so please consider making a donation at www.patreon.com/artofcrimepodcast. Every bit counts and is massively appreciated. As a reminder, be sure to check out the Art of Crime website at www.artofcrimepodcast.com. It features all kinds of images relevant to the show, including maps, drawings, paintings, photographs, sheet music, and more. You can also follow us on Facebook at Art of Crime Podcast, Instagram at Art of Crime Podcast, and Twitter at Art of Crime Pod. If you have questions, comments, or feedback, please don't hesitate to drop me a line at artofcrimepodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time.